You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Amazon is positioning itself to be a bigger player in the digital music and movie market. This week, the company announced that it would offer its movie and music apps on more devices, including Apple's iPad. NPR's Laura Seidel has this report.
Netflix has been the dominant player for streaming movies online, and its app is on almost every device, from Xboxes to iPads. Now, Amazon's added a movie and TV app to the iPad. Should Netflix worry?
Netflix should worry.
Sarah Rotman Epps is an analyst with Forrester Research.
Many consumers are on the fence about Netflix. It helped that they added Mad Men, but they can't let the pressure up of trying to add more premium content.
Amazon has had a lot of success by making its ebooks available on almost every device, and they're trying to do the same with TV and movies. The company's aiming at music as well. This week, Amazon announced its Cloud Player digital music app would soon be available on Roku Internet TV boxes and the Sonos home music streaming service. iTunes has been the leader in digital music, and with the popularity of Apple devices, Rotman Epps thinks that will continue. Now there's speculation that Amazon may soon start selling its own phone.
And then music and video from its services, you know, will have synergy with that device.
Over the next few years, consumers will likely see a lot more choices for online entertainment. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
All this month, NPR will feature stories about small, off-the-beaten-track towns with economies and identities that depend on the arts. Their first stop is the desert town of Marfa, Texas. That's M-A-R-F-A, home to 2,100 people and a slew of art galleries. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
For the glamorous types who attend Art Basel in Miami or Documenta in Germany, or visit Amsterdam for the Rijksmuseum and the drugs, Marfa is a similar station of the cross, says Carolina Miranda. She writes about the art world.
They speak about Marfa with the same kind of reverent tones generally reserved for, like, the pilgrimage of the Virgin of Lourdes.
The acclaimed minimalist artist, Donald Judd, left New York City in the 1970s for this dusty dot of a town. He wanted to escape the art scene he said he despised. He acquired an entire army base, and before he died in 1994, he filled it with art, including light installations by his friend Dan Flavin and Judd's own signature boxes. Two old brick artillery sheds house 100 boxes made of silvery milled aluminum. They sit in quiet, perfect rows. They glow, or depending on the light, seem almost translucent. Now, all 400 acres of the site are run by the Chinati Foundation.
Hot one today.
Docent Sterry Butcher warns visitors to be careful as they head towards the scrubby pasture, where Judd scattered 15 huge boxes made of concrete, as empty and remote as the landscape.
It's unlikely that you would see a snake or a skunk or a porcupine or some other varmint, but it's always possible.
Once, only dedicated Judd fans braved the varmints, the distance, and the heat to see this collection. That's changed.
I'm not hugely knowledgeable.
Jen Kitson came for the art, but maybe also because of the hype. Just in the past 3 years, the New York Times has run almost half a dozen big features about Marfa, one solely on its restaurants, including the inevitable food truck. Driving here, Kitson and her boyfriend saw the fake Prada store that sits on the highway. And then
he turned on the radio and he's like, look, NPR, that's all you can get, NPR.
You're tuned to the Honky Tonk Happy Hour, this and every Thursday evening. I'm your host, David Branch, and I'm going to play the B-side of this deal.
And it was, like, amazing, but then it was also kind of creepy, like, oh, perfect, our NPR station. And then you enter, and then we're like, ooh, look at this, is this restaurant, and oh, they have vegan food.
Vegan food, straw bale houses, funky bars filled with artsy kids clinking shiner bock with famous painters and film directors. Their pearl button shirts and cowboy boots make it feel like a Western-themed outpost of Brooklyn. And for a town of only about 2,000 people, you can amuse yourself endlessly with screenings, readings, and, of course, gallery shows.
No rush. Grab a beer.
This opening for sculptor Campbell Boswell is taking place in the studio space he bought with his wife 11 years ago. It's a slightly dilapidated white wooden church a few blocks from Marfa's single stoplight.
You know, as an artist, you always see cool buildings and go, oh, God, that'd make a great studio. Yeah, but you can't afford it, you know. Or you'd go through some small town and you go, oh, look at that old building. That'd be a great studio. And then you'd go, yeah, but then we'd have to live in that town.
People want to live in Marfa, but there's no hospital. That weeds out retirees. And corporal punishment in the public schools deters families with kids. So the artsy population is limited to the wealthy with part-time homes here, temporary residents on fancy fellowships, and the truly hardcore, like Boswell.
You just come out here and you feel like, I want to make something. I want to do something.
This hardcore community is defined by the intensity of its artistic aspirations and exacting standards for art, says poet Tim Johnson.
It's tough, you know, it's also a highly critical community. So people will let you know if it's second or third rate or whatever.
Have people left because they couldn't take the criticism?
Yeah, I think so.
Johnson runs Martha's Bookstore, heavy on art theory and poetry journals, with yoga classes in the morning. He thinks Donald Judd would wince at Martha's emergence as a chic arts world destination.
He thought that making an art-based tourism was necessarily carnivalesque, which was, for him, anathema to the experience of art. He knew that people would come and see it, but he did not want that to be a large part of the economy because he thought socially that would have a negative impact.
Judd did have dreams about art helping Martha's economy, says Rob Wiener. He directs the Chinati Foundation.
At one point, even bottling the local water, which was terrific water, and he had designed a kind of complex series of bottles that could be turned into bricks once the water was consumed.
That never happened, but Wiener is delighted by the flood of new visitors. 11,000 last year, more than twice the attendance 8 years ago, he says. But he seemed a little offended when I wondered how his marketing has changed.
We've never marketed.
You don't have a marketing plan?
No. Well, no, we don't have a marketing plan.
Do you have a marketing director?
No.
Unlike other towns that have tried to reinvent themselves as arts destinations, it's happened organically here. No one is even keeping track of how much tourism has increased. Khaki Oftengarden Scott is Martha's Chamber of Commerce.
Hi, can I get you guys something? Do something for you?
Oftengarden Scott's helping out a couple of tourists from California. She was not lured to Marfa by the cool factor or Judd's massive concrete blocks. She grew up here.
I thought that the blocks there along the highway were like leftover debris from the military base.
Oftengarden Scott comes from generations of ranchers. Some, she says, have struggled with Martha's transformation.
My parents, they sold their house to a couple of gentlemen from New York City.
That was a big deal for Oftengarden Scott's dad.
Straight-laced guy, cowboy, Republican, Christian. He eats red meat. He likes potatoes. I think it still really trips him out that two men would be sharing his master bedroom.
One of the things Oftengarden Scott hopes to do with the Chamber of Commerce is reconcile old-timers with the transplants they sometimes call Chinazis, after the foundation. She says most of the newcomers are incredibly well-intentioned, but
there's a kind of give and take all the time, but sometimes it seems like there's more taking.
Oftengarden Scott says sure, the arts economy has created jobs, dishwashing or landscaping for native Marfans, mostly low-income and Latino. Higher-income gigs with real mobility tend to go to out-of-towners, who are not oblivious to the impact they're having. Yet, Marfans know the alternative would be worse.
If they hadn't come in, this town would have dried up and blown away.
Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 2nd of August, 2012. It's the anniversary of the first U.S. Census on this day, 1790. U.S. was the first country in the world to make a census mandatory in the Constitution. It needs to be held every 10 years, and it serves as the basis for congressional districting and for electoral votes. In 1790, only the names of the heads of households were recorded, and the number of free white males was counted for draft purposes. Women not allowed to work as census takers, and they were rarely named in the census. Slaves were only counted as 3/5 of a person, Indians not counted at all. So it wasn't really accurate, but the first census recorded just under 4 million people residing in this country. In 2010, almost 310 million residents. It's the birthday of the journalist James Fallows, Philadelphia, 1949, who's written for more than 25 years for The Atlantic magazine, reporting on the economy, on technology, on war and national security. Majored in history and literature at Harvard. He was a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter when he was only 26. He's written a lot about Iraq, articles collected in his book Blind into Baghdad. His most recent book is Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China. James Fallows, who said, make the important interesting. It's the birthday of James Baldwin, the writer, Harlem, 1924, grew up poor, oldest of nine children, worked in sweatshops as a teen, became interested in reading, hung out at the public library. He said, you think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read. It was books that taught me that the things that tormented me most were the very things that connected me with all the people who had ever been alive. He was a Pentecostal preacher at the age of 16, later moved to Greenwich Village, started to come to terms with his homosexuality, was encouraged by the novelist Richard Wright to move to Paris and later to Switzerland, where he finished his first novel, an autobiographical novel about growing up in Harlem, Go Tell It on the Mountain, came out in 1953. Came back to this country to be involved in the civil rights movement, was devastated by the assassinations of Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr., and returned to France in the 70s, where he wrote two more novels and a final collection of poetry, Jimmy's Blues. James Baldwin has said, you write in order to change the world, knowing perfectly well that you probably can't, but also knowing that literature is indispensable to the world. The world changes according to the way people see it. And if you alter even but a millimeter the way people look at reality, then you can change it. Here's a poem for today by Ramon Montaigne, On the Beach. Children playing on the beach, mad dogs running off the leash, babies eating small mud pies, poison puddles in disguise, surfers paddling out to sea. Are there sharks? There well might be. Children walking to and fro. Are they wearing sunscreen? No. Men who go without long pants or shirts are asking for skin cancer. Naked women soon will be sent to chemotherapy. Food left sitting in the sun, salmonella, has begun. Young girls talking to strange men who yesterday were in the pen. The days get hotter near the water here in Sodom. Thank God for autumn. A poem by Ramon Montaigne, On the Beach, used by permission of the poet.